This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Life and Arts with Dominic Green for Spectator USA.
Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm culture editor for Spectator USA, and welcome to our weekly arts and culture podcast. My guest this week is Jamie Kirchick. He's a journalist, author of The End of Europe, and he's also running for the Board of Trustees of Yale University. Jamie, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. You're in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, I'm on a book tour because a book I wrote called The End of Europe has come out in Czech. So
right. How is Europe ending?
It's still got a couple years left, I hope.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. The paperback is on its
exactly.
way. So.
Right.
Now, you're also running a campaign to enter the Board of Trustees of Yale University. Now, often this sort of thing, I assume people do at the end of a glorious career rather than in the middle. What drives you to do this?
Well, there's been a series of events at my alma mater that have been quite disturbing from a perspective of those of us who care about free speech and intellectual diversity. I think the biggest one was a incident that gained quite a bit of international infamy in 2015, and it regarded an email that was sent by the administration informing students as to what Halloween costumes they should avoid wearing, and this was in the absence of any real incidents of, you know, racist Halloween costumes at Yale. It was sort of a unnecessary patronizing administrative fiat, basically, and it led one professor named Erica Christakis to write an email to her students in which she basically said, look, I think you're all adults, and if you see one of your peers wearing a costume that you find particularly troublesome or offensive, I trust you to either speak to them and tell them why you have a problem with it, or perhaps just ignore them. And for writing this email, she was denounced by hundreds of students, about 100 of whom surrounded her husband, Nicholas, in the courtyard of the residential college that they were both masters of at the time. And this is, by the way, the term master, which I'm sure to your British listeners is a very unobjectionable term. It obviously comes from the Oxbridge system. That has now been done away with at Yale because apparently...
It means teacher.
It means teacher, but apparently to some... Yes, some Yale students were claiming that it was racist having to do with, you know, what slaves would call their masters. I mean, just a totally absurd, interpretation of this term. So that term is now gone at Yale. I mean, I went to Yale. I was in Pearson College. We had, you know, the master of Pearson College. It's a very, it's a sort of half academic, half sort of advisory role. They're very beloved by their students. And that term is now gone, and it's been replaced with this very anodyne head of college. And this is sort of reflective of the problems that I'm talking about. But back to the original story, a video of this encounter between Nicholas Christakis and about 100 students screaming in his face, yelling, demanding that he apologize for his wife's misdeeds, that he acknowledge his white privilege, and on and on and on. And it was humiliating, I think, for the university. But what was really bizarre about it was that the administration, instead of telling these students that their behavior was totally unacceptable and irrational, basically caved into their demands and put up $50 million for a diversity initiative and basically told them that they were right to be protesting. And 2 years later, two of the students who led this mob were actually given a prize by the university for racial reconciliation. I'm not joking about that. So a lot of alums, I think, were very disturbed by this experience or this sort of event,
right,
and what it seemed to say about the issues, not only of free speech and intellectual diversity, but also just basic, you know, respect for one another. I mean, we wouldn't want to have students treating each other like this, never mind a person in authority, a professor. And it was this sort of breakdown in sanity, I think, that led me, I guess, to decide to throw my hat into the ring.
So how do you go about becoming a member of the Board of Trustees for anyone who's listening to this and is thinking of it?
So the normal process by which this works is, you know, Yale chooses two alumni candidates every year and puts them on the ballot and presents them to the Yale alumni community. And we get to choose based upon basically just a brief biographical statement, you know, candidate A or candidate B. So to get on the ballot, to kind of bypass this process, one has to get about 4,200 signatures from alums of any of Yale schools. So, you know, Yale College or the medical school or the law school. And I have by October 1st to do that. And if I can accomplish that goal, then I'm on the ballot for next year.
Excellent. And presumably, once you're on the board, you'll be able to influence policy or to at least be a voice of reason.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be one voice among. I bet there's 18 members of the board, and the president is obviously, you know, attending these meetings as well. And I think it's important to have, you know, at least one person who is very much concerned about these particular issues. You know, Yale, the whole process by which trustees are appointed is a, you know, sort of a closed one. I mean, it's the Yale administration basically choosing the candidates that it will have on its board. So they're not, I mean, there are many fine qualities among the people who are being chosen to be on the Board of Trustees, but I don't think that, you know, let's just say a sort of dissident quality is one of them. There's not going to be people there who are going to be seriously questioning the university's position or stance on these particular issues, because that's not why Yale is choosing them to be on the Board of Trustees.
No. I mean, Yale is not the only university to have seen this kind of thing in recent years. It does seem to be a generational phenomenon. I have read reports saying that donations by alumni, for instance, at Oberlin have declined because of, you know, people being disgusted, basically.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a more effective way of reestablishing what a university is for and how people should conduct themselves than, say, being outraged, which is most people's reaction? In other words, to treat it as a contractual problem, as an economic one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously withholding donations is a pretty blunt force instrument, but these universities are quite responsive to, you know, donor pressure. I think just one of the problems is that, you know, the donors haven't felt the need to put on so much pressure. But this is kind of a new, I mean, this has been done before. What I'm doing, you have seen occasionally in the past, you've seen alums try to influence the decision-making process by running candidates for the boards of trustees of various universities, and it's had occasional successes and failures. I'm not really aware of one at Yale to this degree, particularly on these issues. But I do think if anyone's going to save the universities in America, it's going to be the alumni community.
Yeah, I think in business, you have the activist investor who
right.
has a stake and then uses that to raise issues. It seems to be a similar thing. And activist investors do get results.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't. Obviously, the students aren't going to solve this problem. The faculty, you know, for a variety of reasons, is not going to solve the problem. Many of them are, in fact, collaborating or responsible for these problems. They're the ones teaching the students these crazy ideas that lead them to protest things like emails about Halloween costumes. and then the administrative body itself, the administration itself, is largely a part of the problem. I mean, this is, I mean, you've taught at a university in the States or college, so you can attest to this, but the growth of the administrative part of the university, this is the non-academic, you know, sort of busybody deans of various, you know, residential life or deans of diversity or deans of this or that, has grown exponentially over the past several decades. And I think putting shrinking that part of the university's bloat, you know, putting a cap on the growth of the administrative sector is, I think, pretty crucial part of this.
So how did this happen? Because if you, in the early 1960s, people were talking about, say, the University of California system and the multiversity. Mm. And their complaint at that point was that the university was too close to the rest of society, that it was just designed to produce people to learn skills which would make them productive and unfulfilled, allegedly. And now we seem to have arrived at the opposite point where university, well, certainly the part of it that makes the media, is antagonistic to the rest of society and seems to be training people who act out that antagonism in this highly politicized and very dramatizing way. How did we get here from there?
You know, it's a pretty remarkable question. An interesting comparison to be made is actually of that between the student activists of today and those of the 60s. I mean, you mentioned Berkeley and the California system. I mean, that's really where the free speech movement began.
Yes.
And how did it begin? It was anti-Vietnam War protesting students who were being forbidden from handing out literature on the quad, and they protested in favor of free speech, and they were protesting against the administration. And I think whatever you think of their, you know, later political development or your views on the Vietnam War, I think it was a pretty admirable movement, you know, at least in its initial stages, and in that it was, you know, it was anti-authoritarian and pro-freedom. And what's remarkable about the student protesters on campuses today is that they are basically pro-authoritarian. They are demanding that they want to work hand in glove with the administration to crush those the views and the free speech of those with whom they disagree. So it's really antithetical, even though you could both say movements are sort of left-wing. I think it's interesting to see sort of the development of the left from the 60s to today, where, you know, 50 years ago they were anti-authoritarian and pro-free speech, and now they are essentially anti-free speech and authoritarian. And this is a pretty remarkable development.
Is it something to do with where power is and how people behave towards it? And the origins of the university are in the medieval church.
Right.
In other words, the university develops as a servant of power. And there's a great deal of talk in universities. When I say a great deal of talk in universities, I mean in the departments of humanities, because I don't think that the physicists are telling their students we need to speak truth to power. They're telling their students we need to work out how this particle works with that or something. There's a great deal of talk of speaking truth to power, but what we're seeing and what you're describing is speaking a certain version of truth for power. Yes, so there is an institutional relationship between the students. When you're saying they're giving an award to two of the Yale protesters for racial reconciliation, what they've achieved is a reconciliation, surely, between the goals of the administration and the goals of a certain number of the students,
yes,
which is for an alliance, in effect.
Yes, and I'm not sure how ideological it is. I'm sure there are administrators who tacitly agree with the students and make, you know, in their sort of ideological underpinnings and how they view the world. I think a lot of it just frankly has to do with cowardice, and that we have administrators at universities who just don't want to stand up for certain basic values against their own students. And I think, you know, a large part of this too is the way in which the relationship between the administration or a university and its individual students has changed. Now, I think in many universities, particularly the top ones, students are viewed as customers.
Well, they are. They are, though.
They are.
Yes. I mean,
as we know, at least in America, there's a saying, you know, in the retail industry, which is that the customer is always right.
Absolutely. If you're paying $60,000 a year and taking eight courses, well, that works out as, what, $7,500 a course?
Right.
And for that, frankly, you could hire a private tutor in your home and probably get a higher standard of teaching as well.
Sure.
But frankly, for that kind of money, you know, you can understand why. I mean, many students would come up to me and say, I'm not used to getting a B, or I'm not a B kind of person.
Right.
The implication being someone who's paying this much has bought an A grade. And that's definitely changed the balance of power. Yeah,
it does change the balance of power. It's a real serious problem.
So this is going to be a long term process then, which is changing the economic structure of education as well. And I wonder, For a long time, since the GI Bill, really, the assumption was that if you went to university in America, then you were on the escalator rising up socially. The figures don't really support that anymore. There's still a polarized result, as it's a polarized economy, but only around, say, 30 leading colleges supply that extra bit of value that does translate into better jobs, perhaps just because you make the contacts there. What is striking is that the colleges at which this kind of lynch mob behavior is most common are the most expensive ones.
Yes.
That this is not a popular phenomenon, is it? This is actually, you know, the upper class of tomorrow.
That's an interesting observation. I'm sure it has something to do with the fact that if, you know, you are a lower middle class or working class person and you are attending a university, you're probably having your head down and you're studying because you're trying to advance.
And you're getting a lot of debt.
And you're assuming debt, precisely. And you're there to get a degree, and you have a very specific career path, perhaps. And you don't have time, frankly, to engage in this sort of, you know, nonsense. I would also say it's also the humanities where this mostly happens. You don't see the, you know, the physics students or the biology professors signing, you know, petitions demanding that people be fired for their views or for hosting certain speakers or whatnot. This is largely a problem in the humanities. And yes, among, I guess you could say, the top tier schools, where people can afford to behave like this and they can afford to get away with it. And I think that's also, yeah, that's probably why it's more, we see more of this stuff happening at, you know, the Ivy League or liberal arts colleges, and not, say, you know, the University of Chicago, which I think is a rare example of a place that makes a very specific point of telling its incoming freshman class, you know, here are the rules regarding you know, freedom of speech and intellectual diversity, and we're not going to cancel speakers that you don't like, and there's no safe spaces, and there's no trigger warnings, and there's lots of universities and colleges in this country where you can be indulged in these sorts of silly things, but University of Chicago isn't going to be one of them.
I wonder if it's coincidental that the University of Chicago is associated with Milton Friedman and the whole Reaganite economic model and so on, that it actually was a place perhaps where some people had made an accommodation to economic reality in the 1970s rather than retreating into a sort of fantasy kingdom, which was my impression of much of campus life.
That could be part of it. I'm not sure, but I think there's just, you know, it's not necessarily a conservative argument. In fact, I think some of the strongest and best, you know, advocates on these issues that we talk about when we talk about the university are, you know, sort of old-fashioned liberals, small L liberals. And I think there's long been a divide, but there's a real emerging one, and I'm seeing it in my campaign between these sort of old-school liberals who believe in free speech and intellectual diversity, and what you could call sort of the progressives, right, who don't believe in these things. And
there are plenty of people who liked conservative people who are not happy with, you know, free speech. They're very, very hostile to, say, the free speech of Muslims on campus.
Absolutely. No, this is not primarily a left-wing problem. And I think we see it on, you know, particularly at, say, Christian universities or more conservative schools, you'll see the same problems, but from the other political side.
Funnily enough, The Spectator in London has, in the last weeks, had two completely different opinions put forward there. Mm. One saying there is no crisis of free speech, the other saying there is. Where do you stand on this? Do you think there is a genuine widespread crisis of free speech at the moment? Or is it limited to two or three particular places? For instance, the universities or the media?
I think it can be exaggerated by people on the right who want to basically portray themselves as victims and whatnot. You know, I don't think that the world right now is missing the views of Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter. I think they have no problem disseminating their views. But that's not to say that there isn't a problem. And I think if you look at, you know, what I'm more concerned about are the attitudes expressed by young people. If you look at the attitudes of millennials on these crucial questions of free speech, they're not very, you know, encouraging. And these are going to be the future leaders of our country, you know, the future presidents and senators and newspaper editors and foundation heads. And if they don't really have an appreciation for the, you know, most basic fundamental values of the United States and free speech, then that's a serious problem. But it's not just, again, it's not just a problem with the left. I mean, we now have a poll that shows 40% of Republicans think that the government should be able to shut down news outlets based upon, you know, whatever sort of flimsy evidence it has. And this is, you know, this is no doubt influenced, I think, by, you know, having a president who is constantly attacking, you know, the fake news media or calling the media the enemies of the people. So this is a problem that we have in America, I think, on both sides, is a sort of growing intolerance for intellectual diversity and the right for people to speak, regardless of what their political opinions are.
And what you're doing, of course, by running for the Board of Trustees at Yale is to try and put to get to the levers of power, in effect, to try and stabilize this question, would you say?
I think it's to have a voice in the room when these decisions are being made, when there's a crisis that occurs on campus, to have a voice in that room who can basically stand up for these principles. And I think that that's, and I think, you know, Yale is obviously one of the top universities in the country. I think what happens there does matter for the United States in a way that perhaps what happens on other campuses doesn't. And I think people are going to pay attention to developments at Yale more so than they would at most other schools. And so this is a way to, I think, you know, raise consciousness, raise awareness, of the importance of not only free speech, but of what should be the importance of the American university to American society. And to, you know, you mentioned this gap that's growing between academia and American society. And I think that's something that needs to be closed. I think that I don't want to see, you know, American higher education be basically become part of, you know, blue America and just be so completely shut off from half the country. I mean, that's really not.
Yeah. My experience was when I noticed when I was, working as a teaching assistant, that the guaranteed way to get a laugh, in effect, yeah, is if the professor made a crack about Republicans or
sure,
rednecks or, you know, George W. Bush, who was president at yeah, the time. It was a guaranteed way. And actually, when I spoke to the students afterwards, frequently they had much more various opinions about these things, but they had clearly got the message that it was extremely dangerous for them to
yeah,
express a varying opinion. And of course, young people are often quite conformist anyway.
Right.
But they had a real sense that the glittering prizes were going to be withdrawn from them if they were seen to be on the wrong side of things.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That was true when I was a student, and I'm sure it's gotten even worse in the almost 15 years since I graduated.
So if somebody is listening to this and they want to sign up for your candidacy, how
right,
do they go about this?
So they have to be, first of all, they have to be an alum of any Yale school, at least 5 years out, and they can just go to my website, jamieforatrustee.com, and there's instructions there on how they can sign the petition.
Excellent. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and good luck with the book tour.
Thanks so much.
And hopefully we'll hear more as it gets close to October and perhaps have an update on how it's all going. But for the moment, thank you.
Thank you, Dominic.
You've been listening to Spectator USA's weekly arts and culture podcast with me, Dominic Green. I've been talking with Jamie Kirchick about his campaign to get elected to the Yale Board of Trustees. So if there's any Yaleys listening, now is your chance to cast your votes. We'll be back next week with more arts and culture talk. Until then, thank you for listening.